After the war, the release of records of the International Red Cross showed that in South Vietnamese prison camps, where at the height of the war 65,000 to 70,000 people were held and often beaten and tortured, American advisors observed and sometimes participated. The Red Cross observers found continuing systematic brutality at the two principal Vietnamese POW camps, at Phu Quoc and Khi Nhan, where American advisors were stationed. By the end of the Vietnam War, 7 million tons of bombs had been dropped on Vietnam, more than twice the total bombs dropped on Europe and Asia in World War II, almost one 500-pound bomb for every human being in Vietnam. It was estimated that there were 20 million bomb craters in the country. In addition, poisonous sprays were dropped by planes to destroy trees and any kind of growth. An area the size of the state of Massachusetts was covered with such poison. Vietnamese mothers reported birth defects in their children. Yale biologists using the same poison, 245T, on mice, reported defective mice born and said they had no reason to believe the effect on humans was different. On March 16, 1968, a company of American soldiers went into the hamlet of My Lai Four in Quang Nai Province. They rounded up the inhabitants, including old people and women with infants in their arms. These people were ordered into a ditch, where they were methodically shot to death by American soldiers. The testimony of James Dersey, a rifleman, at the later trial of Lieutenant William Calley was reported in the New York Times. Lieutenant Calley and a weeping rifleman named Paul D. Medlow, the same soldier who had fed candy to the children before shooting them, pushed the prisoners into the ditch. There was an order to shoot by Lieutenant Calley. I can't remember the exact words. It was something like, "Start firing." Medlow turned to me and said, "Shoot. Why don't you shoot?" He was crying. I said, "I can't. I won't." Then Lieutenant Calley and Medlow pointed their rifles into the ditch and fired. People were diving on top of each other. Mothers were trying to protect their children. Journalist Seymour Hersh, in his book My Lai Four, writes, "When Army investigators reached the barren area in November 1969, in connection with the My Lai probe in the United States, they found mass graves at three sites, as well as a ditch full of bodies. It was estimated that between 450 and 500 people, most of them women, children, and old men, had been slain and buried there." The Army tried to cover up what happened, but a letter began circulating from a GI named Ron Reidenhauer, who had heard about the massacre. There were photos taken of the killing by an Army photographer, Ronald Haberly. Seymour Hersh, then working for an anti-war news agency in Southeast Asia called Dispatch News Service, wrote about it. The story of the massacre had appeared in May 1968 in two French publications, one called Sud Vietnam en Lutte, and another published by the North Vietnamese delegation to the peace talks in Paris, but the American press did not pay any attention. Several of the officers in the My Lai massacre were put on trial, but only Lieutenant William Calley was found guilty. He was sentenced to life imprisonment, but his sentence was reduced twice. He served 3 years. Nixon ordered that he be under house arrest rather than a regular prison, and then was paroled. Thousands of Americans came to his defense. Part of it was in patriotic justification of his action as necessary against the communists. Part of it seems to have been a feeling that he was unjustly singled out in a war with many similar atrocities. Colonel Orrin Henderson, who had been charged with covering up the My Lai killings, told reporters in early 1971, "Every unit of brigade size has its My Lai hidden someplace." Indeed, My Lai was unique only in its details. Hersh reported a letter sent by a GI to his family and published in a local newspaper. "Dear Mom and Dad, today we went on a mission, and I am not very proud of myself, my friends, or my country. We burned every hut in sight. It was a small rural network of villages, and the people were incredibly poor. My unit burned and plundered their meager possessions. Let me try to explain the situation to you. The huts here are thatched palm leaves. Each one has a dried mud bunker inside. These bunkers are to protect the families, kind of like air raid shelters. My unit commanders, however, chose to think that these bunkers are offensive. So every hut we find that has a bunker, we are ordered to burn to the ground. When the 10 helicopters landed this morning in the midst of these huts, and 6 men jumped out of each chopper, we were firing the moment we hit the ground. We fired into all the huts we could. It is then that we burned these huts. Everyone is crying, begging, and praying that we don't separate them and their husbands and fathers, sons and grandfathers. The women wail and moan. Then they watch in terror as we burn their homes, personal possessions, and food. Yes, we burn all rice and shoot all livestock. The more unpopular became the Saigon government, the more desperate the military effort became to make up for this. A secret congressional report of late 1967 said the Viet Cong were distributing about 5 times more land to the peasants than the South Vietnamese government, whose land distribution program had come to a virtual standstill. The report said, "The Viet Cong have eliminated landlord domination and reallocated lands owned by absentee landlords and the GVN, Government of Vietnam, to the landless and others who cooperate with Viet Cong authorities." The unpopularity of the Saigon government explains the success of the National Liberation Front in infiltrating Saigon and other government-held towns in early 1968 without the people there warning the government. The NLF thus launched a surprise offensive. It was the time of Tet, their New Year holiday, that carried them into the heart of Saigon, immobilized Tanzan Nut Airfield, even occupied the American embassy briefly. The offensive was beaten back, but it demonstrated that all the enormous firepower delivered on Vietnam by the United States had not destroyed the NLF, its morale, its popular support, its will to fight. It caused a reassessment in the American government, more doubts among the American people. The massacre at My Lai by a company of ordinary soldiers was a small event compared with the plans of high-level military and civilian leaders to visit massive destruction on the civilian population of Vietnam. Assistant Secretary of Defense John McNaughton, in early 1966, seeing that large-scale bombing of North Vietnam villages was not producing the desired result, suggested a different strategy. The airstrikes on villages, he said, would create a counterproductive wave of revulsion abroad and at home. He suggested instead, destruction of locks and dams, however, if handled right, might offer promise. It should be studied. Such destruction doesn't kill or drown people. By shallow flooding the rice, it leads after a time to widespread starvation, more than 1 million, unless food is provided, which we could offer to do at the conference table. The heavy bombings were intended to destroy the will of ordinary Vietnamese to resist, as in the bombings of German and Japanese population centers in World War II, despite President Johnson's public insistence that only military targets were being bombed. The government was using language like "one more turn of the screw" to describe bombing. The CIA at one point in 1966 recommended a bombing program of greater intensity, according to the Pentagon Papers, directed against, in the CIA's words, the will of the regime as a target system. Meanwhile, just across the border of Vietnam, in a neighboring country, Laos, where a right-wing government installed by the CIA faced a rebellion, one of the most beautiful areas in the world, the Plain of Jars, was being destroyed by bombing. This was not reported by the government or the press. Fred Bronfman told the story in his book, Voices from the Plain of Jars. Over 25,000 attack sorties were flown against the Plain of Jars from May 1964 through September 1969. Over 75,000 tons of bombs were dropped on it. On the ground, thousands were killed and wounded, tens of thousands driven underground, and the entire above-ground society leveled. Bronfman, who spoke the Laotian language and lived in a village with a Laotian family, interviewed hundreds of refugees from the bombing who poured into the capital city of Vientiane. He recorded their statements and preserved their drawings. A 26-year-old nurse from Dien Quang told of her life in her village. "I was at one with the earth, the air, the upland fields, the paddy and the seed beds of my village. Each day and night, in the light of the moon, I and my friends from the village would wander, calling out and singing, through forest and field, amidst the cries of the birds. During the harvesting and planting season, we would sweat and labor together, under the sun and the rain, contending with poverty and miserable conditions, continuing the farmer's life, which has been the profession of our ancestors. But in 1964 and 1965, I could feel the trembling of the earth and the shock from the sounds of arms exploding around my village. I began to hear the noise of airplanes circling about in the heavens. One of them would stick its head down and, plunging earthward, loose a loud roar, shocking the heart as light and smoke covered everything so that one could not see anything at all. Each day we would exchange news with the neighboring villagers of the bombings that had occurred, the damaged houses, the injured, and the dead. The holes. During that time we needed holes to save our lives. We who were young took our sweat and our strength, which should have been spent raising food in the rice fields and forests to sustain our lives, and squandered it digging holes to protect ourselves. One young woman explained why the revolutionary movement in Laos, the Neo-Lao, attracted her and so many of her friends. As a young girl, I had found that the past had not been very good, for men had mistreated and made fun of women as the weaker sex. But after the Neo-Lao party began to administer the region, it became very different. Under the Neo-Lao, things changed psychologically, such as their teaching that women should be as brave as men. For example, although I had gone to school before, my elders advised me not to. They had said that it would not be useful for me as I could not hope to be a high-ranking official after graduation, that only the children of the elite or rich could expect that. But the Neo-Lao said that women should have the same education as men, and they gave us equal privileges and did not allow anyone to make fun of us. And the old associations were changed into new ones. For example, most of the new teachers and doctors trained were women, and they changed the lives of the very poor, for they shared the land of those who had many rice fields and those who had none. A 17-year-old boy told about the Pathet Lao Revolutionary Army coming to his village. Some people were afraid, mostly those with money. They offered cows to the Pathet Lao soldiers to eat, but the soldiers refused to take them. If they did take them, they paid a suitable price. The truth is that they led the people not to be afraid of anything. Then they organized the election of village and canton chief, and the people were the ones who chose them. In September 1973, a former government official in Laos, Jerome Doolittle, wrote in the New York Times, "The Pentagon's most recent lies about bombing Cambodia bring back a question that often occurred to me when I was press attaché at the American Embassy in Vientiane, Laos. Why did we bother to lie? When I first arrived in Laos, I was instructed to answer all press questions about our massive and merciless bombing campaign in that tiny country with, at the request of the Royal Laotian government, the United States is conducting unarmed reconnaissance flights accompanied by armed escorts who have the right to return if fired upon." This was a lie. Every reporter to whom I told it knew it was a lie. Hanoi knew it was a lie. The International Control Commission knew it was a lie. Every interested congressman and newspaper reader knew it was a lie. After all, the lies did serve to keep something from somebody, and the somebody was us. By early 1968, the cruelty of the war began touching the conscience of many Americans. For many others, the problem was that the United States was unable to win the war. While 40,000 American soldiers were dead by this time, 250,000 wounded, with no end in sight. The Vietnam casualties were many times this number. Lyndon Johnson had escalated a brutal war and failed to win it. His popularity was at an all-time low. He could not appear publicly without a demonstration against him in the war. The chant, "LBJ, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" was heard in demonstrations throughout the country. In the spring of 1968, Johnson announced he would not run again for president, and that negotiations for peace would begin with the Vietnamese in Paris. In the fall of 1968, Richard Nixon, pledging that he would get the United States out of Vietnam, was elected president. He began to withdraw troops. By February 1972, less than 150,000 were left. But the bombing continued. Nixon's policy was Vietnamization. The Saigon government, with Vietnamese ground troops, using American money and air power, would carry on the war. Nixon was not ending the war. He was ending the most unpopular aspect of it, the involvement of American soldiers on the soil of a faraway country. In the spring of 1970, Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger launched an invasion of Cambodia after a long bombardment that the government never disclosed to the public. The invasion not only led to an outcry of protest in the United States, it was a military failure, and Congress resolved that Nixon could not use American troops in extending the war without congressional approval. The following year, without American troops, the United States supported a South Vietnamese invasion of Laos. This too failed. In 1971, 800,000 tons of bombs were dropped by the United States on Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. Meanwhile, the Saigon military regime, headed by President Nguyen Van Thieu, the last of a long succession of Saigon chiefs of state, was keeping thousands of opponents in jail. Some of the first signs of opposition in the United States to the Vietnam War came out of the civil rights movement, perhaps because the experience of black people with the government led them to distrust any claim that it was fighting for freedom. On the very day that Lyndon Johnson was telling the nation in early August 1964 about the Gulf of Tonkin incident and announcing the bombing of North Vietnam, black and white activists were gathering near Philadelphia, Mississippi, at a memorial service for the three civil rights workers killed there that summer. One of the speakers pointed bitterly to Johnson's use of force in Asia, comparing it with the violence used against blacks in Mississippi. In mid-1965, in Macomb, Mississippi, young blacks who had just learned that a classmate of theirs was killed in Vietnam distributed a leaflet. It said, "No Mississippi Negroes should be fighting in Vietnam for the white man's freedom until all the Negro people are free in Mississippi. Negro boys should not honor the draft here in Mississippi. Mothers should encourage their sons not to go. No one has a right to ask us to risk our lives and kill other colored people in Santo Domingo in Vietnam so that the white American can get richer." When Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara visited Mississippi and praised Senator John Stennis, a prominent racist, as a man of very genuine greatness, white and black students marched in protest with placards saying, "In memory of the burned children of Vietnam." The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee declared in early 1966 that the United States is pursuing an aggressive policy in violation of international law and called for withdrawal from Vietnam. That summer, six members of SNCC were arrested for an invasion of an induction center in Atlanta. They were convicted and sentenced to several years in prison. Around the same time, Julian Bond, a SNCC activist who had just been elected to the Georgia House of Representatives, spoke out against the war and the draft, and the House voted that he not be seated because his statements violated the Selective Service Act and tend to bring discredit to the House. The Supreme Court restored Bond to his seat, saying he had the right to free expression under the First Amendment. One of the great sports figures of the nation, Muhammad Ali, the black boxer and heavyweight champion, refused to serve in what he called a white man's war. Boxing authorities took away his title as champion. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke out in 1967 at Riverside Church in New York. "Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and a brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as an American to the leaders of my own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours." young men began to refuse to register for the draft, refused to be inducted if called. As early as May 1964, the slogan, "We Won't Go," was widely publicized. Some who had registered began publicly burning their draft cards to protest the war. One, David O'Brien, burned his draft card in South Boston. He was convicted, and the Supreme Court overruled his argument that this was a protected form of free expression. In October of 1967, there were organized draft card turn-ins all over the country. In San Francisco alone, 300 draft cards were returned to the government. Just before a huge demonstration at the Pentagon that month, a sack of collected draft cards was presented to the Justice Department. By mid-1965, 380 prosecutions were begun against men refusing to be inducted. By mid-1968, that figure was up to 3,305. At the end of 1969, there were 33,960 delinquents nationwide. In May 1969, the Oakland Induction Center, where draftees reported from all of Northern California, reported that of 4,400 men ordered to report for induction, 2,400 did not show up. In the first quarter of 1970, the Selective Service System, for the first time, could not meet its quota. A Boston University graduate student in history, Philip Supina, wrote on May 1, 1968, to his draft board in Tucson, Arizona, "I am enclosing the order for me to report for my pre-induction physical exam for the armed forces. I have absolutely no intention to report for that exam, or for induction, or to aid in any way the American war effort against the people of Vietnam." He ended his letter by quoting the Spanish philosopher Miguel Unamuno, who during the Spanish Civil War said, "Sometimes to be silent is to lie." Supina was convicted and sentenced to 4 years in prison. Early in the war, there had been two separate incidents, barely noticed by most Americans. On November 2, 1965, in front of the Pentagon in Washington, as thousands of employees were streaming out of the building in the late afternoon, Norman Morrison, a 32-year-old pacifist, father of three, stood below the third-floor windows of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, doused himself with kerosene, and set himself afire, giving up his life in protest against the war. Also that year, in Detroit, an 82-year-old woman named Alice Hertz burned herself to death to make a statement against the horror of Indochina. A remarkable change in sentiment took place. In early 1965, when the bombing of North Vietnam began, 100 people gathered on the Boston Common to voice their indignation. On October 15, 1969, the number of people assembled on the Boston Common to protest the war was 100,000. Perhaps 2 million across the nation gathered that day in towns and villages that had never seen an anti-war meeting. In the summer of 1965, a few hundred people had gathered in Washington to march in protest against the war. The first in line, historian Stoughton Lind, SNCC organizer Bob Moses, and longtime pacifist David Dellinger, were splattered with red paint by hecklers. But by 1970, the Washington peace rallies were drawing hundreds of thousands of people. In 1971, 20,000 came to Washington to commit civil disobedience, vying to tie up Washington traffic to express their revulsion against the killing still going on in Vietnam. 14,000 of them were arrested, the largest mass arrest in American history. Hundreds of volunteers in the Peace Corps spoke out against the war. In Chile, 92 volunteers defied the Peace Corps director and issued a circular denouncing the war. 800 former members of the Corps issued a statement of protest against what was happening in Vietnam. The poet Robert Lowell, invited to a White House function, refused to come. Arthur Miller, also invited, sent a telegram to the White House: "When the guns boom, the arts die." Singer Eartha Kitt was invited to a luncheon on the White House lawn and shocked all those present by speaking out in the presence of the president's wife against the war. A teenager, called to the White House to accept a prize, came and criticized the war. In Hollywood, local artists erected a 60-foot tower of protest on Sunset Boulevard. At the National Book Award ceremonies in New York, 50 authors and publishers walked out on a speech by Vice President Humphrey in a display of anger at his role in the war. In London, two young Americans gate-crashed the American ambassador's elegant 4th of July reception and called out a toast to all the dead and dying in Vietnam. They were carried out by guards. In the Pacific Ocean, two young American seamen hijacked an American munitions ship to divert its load of bombs from air bases in Thailand. For 4 days, they took command of the ship and its crew, taking amphetamine pills to stay awake until the ship reached Cambodian waters. The Associated Press reported in late 1972 from York, Pennsylvania, 5 anti-war activists were arrested by the state police today for allegedly sabotaging railroad equipment near a factory that makes bomb casings used in the Vietnam War. Middle class and professional people, unaccustomed to activism, began to speak up. In May 1970, the New York Times reported from Washington, 1,000 establishment lawyers joined war protest. Corporations began to wonder whether the war was going to hurt their long-range business interests. The Wall Street Journal began criticizing the continuation of the war. As the war became more and more unpopular, people in or close to the government began to break out of the circle of assent. The most dramatic instance was the case of Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg was a Harvard-trained economist, a former Marine officer, employed by the Rand Corporation, which did special, often secret research for the U.S. government. Ellsberg helped write the Department of Defense history of the war in Vietnam, and then decided to make the top-secret document public with the aid of his friend, Anthony Russo, a former Rand Corporation man. The two had met in Saigon, where both had been affected in different experiences by direct sight of the war, and had become powerfully indignant at what the United States was doing to the people of Vietnam. Ellsberg and Russo spent night after night, after hours, at a friend's advertising agency, duplicating the 7,000-page document. Then Ellsberg gave copies to various congressmen and to the New York Times. In June 1971, the Times began printing selections from what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. It created a national sensation. The Nixon administration tried to get the Supreme Court to stop further publication, but the court said this was prior restraint of the freedom of the press and thus unconstitutional. The government then indicted Ellsberg and Russo for violating the Espionage Act by releasing classified documents to unauthorized people. They faced long terms in prison if convicted. The judge, however, called off the trial during the jury deliberations because the Watergate events unfolding at the time revealed unfair practices by the prosecution. Ellsberg, by his bold act, had broken with the usual tactic of dissidents inside the government who bided their time and kept their opinions to themselves, hoping for small changes in policy. A colleague urged him not to leave the government because there he had access, saying, "Don't cut yourself off. Don't cut your throat." Ellsberg replied, "Life exists outside the executive branch." The anti-war movement, early in its growth, found a strange new constituency, priests and nuns of the Catholic Church. Some of them had been aroused by the civil rights movement, others by their experiences in Latin America, where they saw poverty and injustice under governments supported by the United States. In the fall of 1967, Father Philip Berrigan, a Josephite priest who was a veteran of World War II, joined by artist Tom Lewis and friends David Eberhard and James Mengel, went to the office of a draft board in Baltimore, Maryland, drenched the draft records with blood, and waited to be arrested. They were put on trial and sentenced to prison terms of 2 to 6 years. The following May, Philip Berrigan, out on bail in the Baltimore case, was joined in a second action by his brother Daniel, a Jesuit priest who had visited North Vietnam and seen the effects of U.S. bombing. They and 7 other people went into a draft board office in Catonsville, Maryland, removed records, and set them afire outside in the presence of reporters and onlookers. They were convicted and sentenced to prison, and became famous as the Catonsville Nine. Dan Berrigan wrote a meditation at the time of the Catonsville incident. "Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children, the angering of the orderlies in the front parlor of the charnel house. We could not, so help us God, do otherwise. We say, killing is disorder, life and gentleness and community and unselfishness is the only order we recognize. For the sake of that order, we risk our liberty, our good name. The time has passed when good men can remain silent, when obedience can segregate men from public risk, when the poor can die without defense. When his appeals had been exhausted and he was supposed to go to prison, Daniel Berrigan disappeared. While the FBI searched for him, he showed up at an Easter festival at Cornell University, where he had been teaching. With dozens of FBI men looking for him in the crowd, he suddenly appeared on stage. Then the lights went out. He hid inside a giant figure of the Bread and Puppet Theater, which was on stage, was carried out to a truck, and escaped to a nearby farmhouse. He stayed underground for 4 months, writing poems, issuing statements, giving secret interviews, appearing suddenly in a Philadelphia church to give a sermon, and then disappearing again, baffling the FBI, until an informer's interception of a letter disclosed his whereabouts and he was captured and imprisoned. The one woman among the Catonsville Nine, Mary Moylan, a former nun, also refused to surrender to the FBI. She was never found. Writing from underground, she reflected on her experience and how she came to it. We had all known we were going to jail, so we all had our toothbrushes. I was just exhausted. I took my little box of clothes and stuck it under the cot and climbed into bed. Now all the women in the Baltimore County Jail were black. I think there was only one white. The women were waking me up and saying, "Aren't you going to cry?" I said, "What about?" They said, "You're in jail." And I said, "Yeah, I knew I'd be here." I was sleeping between two of these women, and every morning I'd wake up and they'd be leaning on their elbows watching me. They'd say, "You slept all night," and they couldn't believe it. They were good. We had good times. I suppose the political turning point in my life came while I was in Uganda. I was there when American planes were bombing the Congo, and we were very close to the Congo border. The planes came over and bombed two villages in Uganda. Where the hell did the American planes come in? Later, I was in Dar es Salaam, and Chou En Lai came to town. The American embassy sent out letters saying that no Americans were to be on the street, because this was a dirty communist leader. But I decided this was a man who was making history, and I wanted to see him. When I came home from Africa, I moved to Washington, and had to deal with the scene there and the insanity and brutality of the cops, and the type of life that was led by most of the citizens of that city, 70% black. And then Vietnam, and the napalm, and the defoliants, and the bombings. I got involved with the women's movement about a year ago. At the time of Catonsville, going to jail made sense to me, partially because of the black scene, so many blacks forever filling the jails. I don't think it a valid tactic anymore. I don't want to see people marching off to jail with smiles on their faces. I just don't want them going. The 70s are going to be very difficult, and I don't want to waste the sisters and brothers we have by marching them off to jail and having mystical experiences or whatever they're going to have. The effect of the war and of the bold action of some priests and nuns was to crack the traditional conservatism of the Catholic community. On Moratorium Day, 1969, at the Newton College of the Sacred Heart near Boston, a sanctuary of bucolic quiet and political silence, the great front door of the college displayed a huge painted red fist. At Boston College, a Catholic institution, 6,000 people gathered that evening in the gymnasium to denounce the war. Students were heavily involved in the early protests against the war. A survey by the Urban Research Corporation for the first 6 months of 1969 only, and for only 232 of the nation's 2,000 institutions of higher education, showed that at least 215,000 students had participated in campus protests, that 3,652 had been arrested, that 956 had been suspended or expelled. Even in the high schools in the late 60s, there were 500 underground newspapers. At the Brown University commencement in 1969, two-thirds of the graduating class turned their backs when Henry Kissinger stood up to address them. The climax of protest came in the spring of 1970, when President Nixon ordered the invasion of Cambodia. At Kent State University in Ohio on May 4th, when students gathered to demonstrate against the war, National Guardsmen fired into the crowd. Four students were killed. One was paralyzed for life. students at 400 colleges and universities went on strike in protest. It was the first general student strike in the history of the United States. During that school year of 1969-1970, the FBI listed 1,785 student demonstrations, including the occupation of 313 buildings. The commencement day ceremonies after the Kent State killings were unlike any the nation had ever seen. From Amherst, Massachusetts, came this newspaper report. The 100th commencement of the University of Massachusetts yesterday was a protest, a call for peace. The roll of the funeral drum set the beat for 2,600 young men and women marching in fear, in despair, and in frustration. Red fists of protest, white peace symbols, and blue doves were stenciled on black academic gowns, and nearly every other senior wore an armband representing a plea for peace. Student protests against the ROTC, Reserve Officers Training Program, resulted in the canceling of those programs in over 40 colleges and universities. In 1966, 191,749 college students enrolled in ROTC. By 1973, the number was 72,459. The ROTC was depended on to supply half the officers in Vietnam. In September 1973, for the sixth straight month, the ROTC could not fulfill its quota. One Army official said, "I just hope we don't get into another war, because if we do, I doubt we could fight it." The publicity given to the student protest created the impression that the opposition to the war came mostly from middle-class intellectuals. When some construction workers in New York attacked student demonstrators, the news was played up in the national media. However, a number of elections in American cities, including those where mostly blue-collar workers lived, showed that anti-war sentiment was strong in the working classes. For instance, in Dearborn, Michigan, an automobile manufacturing town, a poll as early as 1967 showed 41% of the population favored withdrawal from the Vietnam War. In 1970, in two counties in California where petitioners placed the issue on the ballot, San Francisco County and Marin County, referenda asking withdrawal of the U.S. forces from Vietnam received a majority vote. In late 1970, when a Gallup poll presented the statement, "The United States should withdraw all troops from Vietnam by the end of next year," 65% of those questioned said yes. In Madison, Wisconsin, in the spring of 1971, a resolution calling for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. forces from Southeast Asia won by 31,000 to 16,000. In 1968, such a resolution had lost. But the most surprising data were in a survey made by the University of Michigan. This showed that throughout the Vietnam War, Americans with only a grade school education were much stronger for withdrawal from the war than Americans with a college education. In June 1966, of people with a college education, 27% were for immediate withdrawal from Vietnam. Of people with only a grade school education, 41% were for immediate withdrawal. By September 1970, both groups were more anti-war. 47% of the college educated were for withdrawal, and 61% of grade school graduates. There is more evidence of the same kind. In an article in the American Sociological Review, June 1968, Richard F. Hamilton found in his survey of public opinion, "Preferences for tough policy alternatives are most frequent among the following groups: the highly educated, high-status occupations, those with high incomes, younger persons, and those paying much attention to newspapers and magazines." And a political scientist, Harlan Hahn, doing a study of various city referenda on Vietnam, found support for withdrawal from Vietnam highest in groups of lower socioeconomic status. He also found that the regular polls, based on samplings, underestimated the opposition to the war among lower-class people. All this was part of a general change in the entire population of the country. In August of 1965, 61% of the population thought the American involvement in Vietnam was not wrong. By May 1971, it was exactly reversed. 61% thought our involvement was wrong. Bruce Andrews, a Harvard student of public opinion, found that the people most opposed to the war were people over 50, blacks, and women. He also noted that a study in the spring of 1964, when Vietnam was a minor issue in the newspapers, showed that 53% of college-educated people were willing to send troops to Vietnam, but only 33% of grade school-educated people were so willing. It seems that the media, themselves controlled by higher education, higher income people who were more aggressive in foreign policy, tended to give the erroneous impression that working class people were super patriots for the war. Louis Lipsitz, in a mid-1968 survey of poor blacks and whites in the South, paraphrased an attitude he found typical. The only way to help the poor man is to get out of that war in Vietnam. These taxes, high taxes, it's going over yonder to kill people with, and I don't see no cause in it. The capacity for independent judgment among ordinary Americans is probably best shown by the swift development of anti-war feeling among American GIs, volunteers and draftees who came mostly from lower-income groups. There had been, earlier in American history, instances of soldiers' disaffection from the war, isolated mutinies in the Revolutionary War, refusal of reenlistment in the midst of hostilities in the Mexican War, desertion and conscientious objection in World War I and World War II. But Vietnam produced opposition by soldiers and veterans on a scale and with a fervor never seen before. It began with isolated protests. As early as June 1965, Richard Steinke, a West Point graduate in Vietnam, refused to board an aircraft taking him to a remote Vietnamese village. "The Vietnamese War," he said, "is not worth a single American life." Steinke was court-martialed and dismissed from the service. The following year, three Army privates, one black, one Puerto Rican, one Lithuanian Italian, all poor, refused to embark for Vietnam, denouncing the war as immoral, illegal, and unjust. They were court-martialed and imprisoned. In early 1967, Captain Howard Levy, an Army doctor at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, refused to teach Green Berets, a special forces elite in the military. He said they were murderers of women and children and killers of peasants. He was court-martialed on the grounds that he was trying to promote disaffection among enlisted men by his statements. The colonel who presided at the trial said, "The truth of the statements is not an issue in this case." Levy was convicted and sentenced to prison. The individual acts multiplied. A black private in Oakland refused to board a troop plane to Vietnam, although he faced 11 years of hard labor. A Navy nurse, Lieutenant Susan Schnall, was court-martialed for marching in a peace demonstration while in uniform and for dropping anti-war leaflets from a plane on Navy installations. In Norfolk, Virginia, a sailor refused to train fighter pilots because he said the war was immoral. An Army lieutenant was arrested in Washington, D.C. in early 1968 for picketing the White House with a sign that said, "120,000 American casualties. Why?" Two black Marines, George Daniels and William Harvey, were given long prison sentences, Daniels 6 years, Harvey 10 years, both later reduced, for talking to other black Marines against the war. As the war went on, desertions from the armed forces mounted. Thousands went to Western Europe, France, Sweden, Holland. Most deserters crossed into Canada. Some estimates were 50,000, others 100,000. Some stayed in the United States. A few openly defied the military authorities by taking sanctuary in churches, where, surrounded by anti-war friends and sympathizers, they waited for capture and court-martial. At Boston University, 1,000 students kept vigil for 5 days and nights in the chapel, supporting an 18-year-old deserter, Ray Kroll. Kroll's story was a common one. He had been inveigled into joining the Army. He came from a poor family, was brought into court, charged with drunkenness, and given the choice of prison or enlistment. He enlisted. And then he began to think about the nature of the war. On a Sunday morning, federal agents showed up at the Boston University Chapel, stomped their way through aisles clogged with students, smashed down doors, and took Kroll away. From the stockade, he wrote back to friends, "I ain't gonna kill, it's against my will." A friend he had made at the chapel brought him books, and he noted a saying he had found in one of them. "What we have done will not be lost to all eternity. Everything ripens at its time and becomes fruit at its hour." The GI anti-war movement became more organized. near Fort Jackson, South Carolina, the first GI coffee house was set up, a place where soldiers could get coffee and donuts, find anti-war literature, and talk freely with others. It was called the UFO and lasted for several years before it was declared a public nuisance and closed by court action. But other GI coffee houses sprang up in half a dozen other places across the country. An anti-war bookstore was opened near Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and another one at the Newport, Rhode Island Naval Base. Underground newspapers sprang up at military bases across the country. By 1970, more than 50 were circulating. Among them, About Face in Los Angeles, Fed Up in Tacoma, Washington, Short Times at Fort Jackson, Vietnam GI in Chicago, Graffiti in Heidelberg, Germany, Brag Briefs in North Carolina, Last Harass at Fort Gordon, Georgia, Helping Hand at Mountain Home Air Base, Idaho. These newspapers printed anti-war articles, gave news about the harassment of GIs, and practical advice on the legal rights of servicemen told how to resist military domination. Mixed with feeling against the war was resentment at the cruelty, the dehumanization of military life. In the army prisons, the stockades, this was especially true. In 1968, at the Presidio Stockade in California, a guard shot to death an emotionally disturbed prisoner for walking away from a work detail. 27 prisoners then sat down and refused to work, singing, "We Shall Overcome." They were court-martialed, found guilty of mutiny, and sentenced to terms of up to 14 years, later reduced after much public attention and protest. The dissidents spread to the war front itself. When the Great Moratorium Day demonstrations were taking place in October 1969 in the United States, some GIs in Vietnam wore black armbands to show their support. A news photographer reported that in a platoon on patrol near Da Nang, about half of the men were wearing black armbands. One soldier stationed at Chu Chi wrote to a friend on October 26, 1970, that separate companies had been set up for men refusing to go into the field to fight. "It's no big thing here anymore to refuse to go." The French newspaper, Le Monde, reported that in 4 months, 109 soldiers of the 1st Air Cavalry Division were charged with refusal to fight. A common sight, the correspondent for Le Monde wrote, is the black soldier with his left fist clenched in defiance of a war he has never considered his own. Wallace Terry, a black American reporter for Time magazine, taped conversations with hundreds of black soldiers. He found bitterness against army racism, disgust with the war, generally low morale. More and more cases of fragging were reported in Vietnam, incidents where servicemen rolled fragmentation bombs under the tents of officers who were ordering them into combat or against whom they had other grievances. The Pentagon reported 209 fraggings in Vietnam in 1970 alone. Veterans back from Vietnam formed a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. In December 1970, hundreds of them went to Detroit to what was called the Winter Soldier Investigations to testify publicly about atrocities they had participated in or seen in Vietnam, committed by Americans against Vietnamese. In April 1971, more than 1,000 of them went to Washington, D.C., to demonstrate against the war. One by one, they went up to a wire fence around the Capitol, threw over the fence the medals they had won in Vietnam, and made brief statements about the war, sometimes emotionally, sometimes in icy, bitter calm. In the summer of 1970, 28 commissioned officers of the military, including some veterans of Vietnam, saying they represented about 250 other officers, announced formation of the Concerned Officers Movement Against the War. During the fierce bombings of Hanoi and Haiphong around Christmas 1972, came the first defiance of B-52 pilots who refused to fly those missions. On June 3, 1973, the New York Times reported dropouts among West Point cadets. Officials there, the reporter wrote, linked the rate to an affluent, less disciplined, skeptical, and questioning generation, and to the anti-military mood that a small radical minority in the Vietnam War had created. But most of the anti-war action came from ordinary GIs, and most of these came from lower-income groups, white, black, Native American, Chinese. A 20-year-old New York City Chinese-American named Sam Choi enlisted at 17 in the Army, was sent to Vietnam, was made a cook, and found himself the target of abuse by fellow GIs, who called him chink and gook, the term for the Vietnamese, and said he looked like the enemy. One day he took a rifle and fired warning shots at his tormentors. By this time I was near the perimeter of the base and was thinking of joining the Viet Cong. At least they would trust me. Choi was taken by military police, beaten, court-martialed, sentenced to 18 months of hard labor at Fort Leavenworth. They beat me up every day, like a time clock. He ended his interview with the New York Chinatown newspaper saying, "One thing, I want to tell all the Chinese kids that the army made me sick. They made me so sick that I can't stand it."